Yeah, I can take, sure.
Did your survey ask women about whether they were depressed after pregnancy?
Yes.
And which was higher? Is that the same?
You know, I'm trying to remember. I believe, I know that they're significantly correlated in our data, that women who report depression after pregnancy were likely to report it enduring, and I can't remember the exact number. I believe it was higher. You know, it might have actually been similar. It was either similar or slightly higher in the postpartum period.
In Oregon, we found about 40% more likely to report depression during pregnancy than after, which surprised us. We thought that the main problem was postpartum.
Right. Yeah. You know, I can, and I haven't yet, but that was also one of the things that, and in this next presentation, and we did look at that, but that was another thing, especially when we add in the social support, we'll need to look at that.
What was the question?
She was asking if I had looked at foreign-born versus U.S.-born by race. And we generally have enough response in all of our race categories to break it out that way. Any other questions on that one? Max.
I'm not familiar with this topic, so with the higher income or the lower, I guess higher income, lower depression,
mm-hmm.
Is there any reason you can decide why? Or is there maybe stigma in that community of meanness or something?
So what you see is that as your income increases, you report less depression. I mean, a lot of that could just come from, the other thing is that we didn't measure in that study was the maternal stress, and having a lower income and less support, less education also can contribute to depression just because of the stressors that you have that would be magnified compared to a woman in a more secure financial situation. So, yeah. Okay. All right. All right, so this talk is my colleague, Yvonne Lau, and she was unable to make it, so I'm going to try and do my best for her. So this is disparities in the availability of social network support to pregnant mothers, and this is using also the same 2005 LAM data, and still no financial relationships. So why bother studying social support? Well, racial and ethnic disparities in adverse birth outcomes cannot be fully explained by differences in income and risk behaviors. Previous studies have also consistently shown a strong relationship between social disadvantage and low birth weight. And one pathway worth exploring is to look at the psychological and physiological stress associated with social disadvantage and how that increases the likelihood of an adverse birth outcome. And social support may have a mediating effect on the relationship between life stress and the development of pregnancy complications. And finally, social support promotes a mother's well-being and her likelihood of having healthful behaviors while she's pregnant. So this is the hypothesized social support model that my colleague developed. And one of the things we know is that stressful events lead to more risky behaviors in pregnant women, like drinking and smoking and drug use, and these are known risk factors for low birth weight. And at the same time, stress can biologically cause early labor and delivery. And while we may not be able to change the stressful events that a woman experiences while pregnant, social support may be a way of providing an intervention to alleviate that stress. So the objectives of this study were to identify the disparities in social support available to pregnant women, and then to examine the effect of social support and maternal stress on birth outcomes and maternal well-being. And for birth outcomes, she's looking at low birth weight and preterm. And so the methods, again, I won't go through it again. It's the LAM survey, the population-based from 2005, about 5,500 women. So she was looking at measuring instrumental and emotional social support during pregnancy. And so the questions that are listed here in yellow measure the instrumental support, and the one in green is the emotional support. So we asked women, during your last pregnancy, would you have been able to receive the kinds of help listed below if you had needed them? And so we asked someone to loan me money, someone to help me if I were sick and needed to be in bed, someone to take me to the clinic or doctor if I needed a ride, someone to help with things I had to do, someone to give me advice or information, and someone to listen to me about my problems. And then by adding all of the yes responses for these items together, we get a composite score that ranges from 0 to 6. And then to measure maternal stress, we use the life events list, which was adopted from PRAMS. And then she looked at the outcomes. Low birth weight and preterm both come from the birth certificate, because similar to PRAMS, this is linked data, so we have all the birth certificate information available. Maternal depression is measured the same way I mentioned earlier. And then maternal mood was measured with a question that asked them, how would you describe the time enduring your pregnancy? And the options ranged from a happy time with few problems to one of the worst times of my life. And then we're going to have some descriptive analysis again. We also did a correlational analysis to look for the Pearson correlation coefficients. And then variables that were found to be important in the correlation analysis were included into the later multivariate analysis, which also controlled for confounding variables such as education, marital status, race, and age. And these results are presented slightly different. So these aren't the weighted responses, which is why they look different than my results, because mine were the weighted. So this is just a breakdown of the actual sample of surveys that we received back. So you can see it's a pretty even distribution by race, which is by design so that we have enough numbers. And these are the results for the individual social support questions. And what the bars are showing are the mothers responding yes to the help availability questions. And on average we see that 60 to 80% of women said that help would be available for the various questions if they needed it. Women were least likely to find someone to lend them money, but most likely to find someone to give them advice or take them to a clinic if they needed help. When we look at these results by race, ethnicity, if you look at the composite scores, we see that for white women, they had an average support score of 5.02, whereas the Hispanic women had the lowest average score, which was 4.04. And this is controlling for income, marital status, and age. We also found that Hispanic and African American mothers both were 60% more likely to have low levels of social support when compared to white mothers. And in this case, we did look at it by the foreign-born and U.S.-born mothers, and we found that across the board for all race ethnicity groups, U.S.-born mothers had a greater level of social support available to them. We found that controlling for income, marital status, and age, foreign-born mothers are 50% or 57% more likely to have a low level of social support than U.S.-born mothers. And there's also a significant trend when you look at number of years lived in the United States, so that the longer they've been here, the greater their social support. And this is the results by marital status, which is not surprising. We see that women who are married have a greater social support score than those women who are unmarried, and this was a statistically significant difference. And here's the educational attainment, and we see that those with greater than a high school education have a higher level of social support score. And we see this same trend when we look at increasing income levels. So women with a greater income also report a greater level of social support. So if we go back to this model, what's shown here are the Pearson correlation coefficients, and only those that were statistically significant are shown. And the definition of stressful events here is the presence of one or more stressful events out of a list of questions that we had asked. And the definition of risk behaviors is reported smoking, drinking, or drug use enduring your pregnancy. And we found that those with higher levels of stress are more likely to have risk-taking behaviors during their pregnancy, and that social support was related to a lower stress level. Social support, however, was not found to be correlated with the preterm or low birth weight outcomes. So in the multivariate analysis, after controlling for marital status, educational level, age, and race, social support was not found to be associated with the birth outcomes, preterm or low birth weight. We also found that for stressful events, they were not independently associated with the birth outcomes. But we did find that social support has a cushioning effect to maternal risk behaviors as a result of stress. So among women with a low level of social support, women who reported stressful events that fell into the low-level social support category were 2 times as likely to have harmful health behaviors. And women in the level in the group who reported high levels of social support, when they reported stressful events, they were only 1.4 times as likely to report harmful health behaviors. So it just reduced the impact of stress on harmful health behaviors during pregnancy. And then the low level of social support also increases the likelihood of depression by 62%. And low level of social support also increases the likelihood of mothers reporting the time of pregnancy as being a difficult time, which was that maternal mood question. So social support is an important factor in mediating maternal stress during pregnancy. However, the relationship of social support and pregnancy outcome was not directly observed in this study. And strengths, again, are the large sample size, and I believe that was a typo. It is a representative sample, so the unknown shouldn't be there. And we use a clear pathway approach for this analysis. And limitations, again, recall, bias, and the chronic stressors. And what we mean by that is that chronic stress is not captured in this survey. So besides the stressful life events that we ask about, the small daily hassles can accumulate to create chronic stress, and that wouldn't be captured in this analysis. And so social support availability varied by race and ethnicity and also different social and demographic groups. Similar to some intervention studies, we saw that additional social support showed no association with birth outcome, but was associated with improvements in maternal psychosocial outcomes. And further research and intervention should focus on reducing the disparity in social support to women and their families before and during pregnancy. And in Los Angeles County, we have a lot of collaborative groups that we work with. So we want to continue to work with the Los Angeles County Preconception Health Collaborative and the Los Angeles Perinatal Mental Health Task Force to reduce disparities in social support networks and continue to collaborate with groups that we run in our program, like the Black Infant Health Program, Comprehensive Perinatal Services Program. And then we want to continue to work with community-based organizations to develop provider care modules and action plans. And these are her references. And that's it. I can take some questions if you have them.
What's interesting to me about this is that the studies were, you know, based on very similar kinds of surveys and focusing on the issues of mental health and the similarities and of the findings, and some of that were quite intriguing. But I don't know if there's other questions or that the audience would like to ask. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so why don't you come up and answer from here so we can record the answers? So come on down. And then I'll have one of you repeat her question so it gets recorded and everybody can hear it.
Okay. No, no question. So the ICD-9 does not have any code that says whether people are taking medication or not. Now, we do plan to take our database and link it to the substance abuse treatment, so we'll be able to find if they were in the public system for substance abuse. So that is, but my suspicion is that, this is just a hypothesis, is that on the delivery record, since 43% of the women were identified as a comorbidity, I suspect that that's mainly depression and women are on drugs or, on medication at delivery. People might chart that, put that as, what would make you put an ICD-9 down as a diagnosis, to know that? So are you asking every woman when she comes in labor? Probably you're asking if she's on medication or, that's just my hypothesis, but no, that's definitely a missing part.
And then for our studies, it was 39% that reported having depressed feelings, and then only 3% of those who reported being diagnosed. So among that small 3% who were diagnosed, it was somewhere between 30 and 40% that were actually on medications. There was a follow-up question, but it ends up being such a small number of people that it's can't be really included, and I don't think would impact my results.
I have a question. I've heard, and I think I've read, that pregnancy itself is a risk factor for onset of a lot of mental health problems, such as, bipolar disorder, that can come out during pregnancy or the postpartum period. Do you have a sense of what sort of percent of the women in your data set that was the onset of their issues?
Yeah.
I know you mentioned
that. Yeah, we can't tell.
Do you have a sense from other data?
In terms of the question was, does pregnancy bring an onset of some mental disorders like bipolar disorder? And we can't tell from our data. It's just what it is. I mean, we can look at how many had that primary diagnosis, so if it was out of control or not, but you don't know whether that was the onset or not. And, often, I've taken care of pregnant women, they may stop taking their medication during pregnancy, so you'll get a bipolar episode or a depression episode because they stopped taking their medication. So
this came up, and so in the 2007 version of the survey, we ask, in the 6 months before you were pregnant, did you have any of the following conditions? And two of the choices are anxiety and depression. So when the data collection is almost done right now for 2007, and so then I can look at the baseline and see how that differs from women in 2005 that reported during.
I have a question for Chandra. I was just surprised at your results for the Asian Pacific Islanders, because in Massachusetts, when we assess Asian Pacific Islanders, it's always the lowest group for everything. Mm-hmm. So I don't know who your group is in LA, if they differ, in terms of ethnicity or how they are. Because it's just to have the higher depression rates as well, because a lot of times, there's been a lot. Yeah, or lower because it's not recognized. They have the cultural somatization of things like depression is different in different cultures. So
I think because for us that Asian Pacific Islander group in Los Angeles is such a mixed bag. I mean, because we do ask women if they weren't born in the United States, where were you born? And I mean, we literally have countries I've never even heard of. So it's Los Angeles just has people from everywhere, and that Asian Pacific Islander ends up being a pretty mixed group. We kind of put them all together. So I think probably the foreign versus U.S. born has a lot to do with our Asian Pacific Islander group being higher than whites in terms of some of our risk assessments.
I had a question as well. What is this is a question for you, so you may want to come up and answer it, or maybe Ken can answer this as well. When you ask the physical activity question, one of the things we've found, because we have that on our birth certificate, and it's physical activity during pregnancy, our birth certificate coders that we work with don't quite know how to respond to the question when we're asking it of women who are migrants, because their physical labor that they have during their work, they don't really need to do a lot of other physical activity, such as what is carried. Well, and the question lists the kinds of activities, and I didn't see anything that was like work-related physical activity. So I didn't know whether that you'd done any work to try to figure out how to capture work-related physical activity that would certainly help somebody meet that physical activity requirement. So I don't know if you want to answer that.
Yeah, I don't know how well I can answer it, but Ken can shout over here and I can repeat. You know, I think they left the question specifically the way they did, and it really doesn't capture work-related physical activity very well, which, you know, that might be one of the findings why actually lower income did slightly better with physical activity. Maybe that work-related physical activity, people, my feeling is that people kind of integrate it. So when you ask them a question like that and they say, I do pretty, you know, I'm a waitress, I'm on my feet all day long and I carry stuff back and forth, you know, that's probably, you probably meet those guidelines. That's my sense.
What you're picking up, Ann, is there's this weird schizophrenia almost in the physical activity literature. Yeah. That there are some people, I mean, it just really doesn't make sense to make a distinction between recreational physical activity and total. And yet the literature, a good two-thirds of physical activity literature focuses on recreational physical activity. I don't know whether it's because it's harder to quantify total. I mean, in effect, you need to sort of tell people something about their work, or whether you. But it actually, I think, makes no sense to be asking purely about recreational, because presumably, if one kind of physical activity, the body doesn't know the difference.
Right. Okay.
Maybe you can mail out pedometers with the survey in future years.
You could actually just change.
Right.
Make the question including your work.
Right.
And I mean, you have to change the question a little bit, but yeah, you could do that. Mm-hmm.
But you guys haven't done any testing with that, or anybody's done any testing with that question, because your issue was whether you're thinking, well, maybe people automatically think more broadly than the specifics, so maybe so we don't know if they're kind of interpolating and answering it that way. But have you guys done any work or? To see if people are interpreting it that way?
Do you remember whether this is a CDC question or an Oregon question?
I think it's a CDC question.
Yeah. So CDC probably has, they send stuff to through their cognitive testing. Mm-hmm. They make more of that than I do. I mean, I've seen some bad questions come through our cognitive testing lab.
Right.
But I think probably nobody's explored it in the way that you're talking about, mm-hmm. and it absolutely.
Well, yeah, given the level, given the interest in physical activity these days, it's becoming important to ask the right person.
And they do say yard work and, like, sweeping. So, I mean, that kind of gives you the sense that it's not just fun and game. You know, right. Like, you can count things, although I don't consider yard work fun, but I know many people reportedly do. So.
The other thing, though, that I think is probably even more limiting in the work that you and I did was 14 weeks postpartum. It's kind of a funny time to be asking women about physical activity. The reason you're asking the question, presumably, has to do with are these women going to lose all or most of the weight they gained from pregnancy? And I'd be curious to hear what people's impression is about what's a reasonable time to ask that question. It's not clear to me 14 weeks is.
So you're saying, you're thinking it's not soon, it's too soon?
I'm thinking it's too soon.
Because they aren't in any kind of a normal pattern. And
I mean, let's assume that there is a typical normative woman who will, in fact, by the time she's a year postpartum, will have gotten back to pretty close to her pre-pregnancy weight. And exercise is part of her activity. She's clearly not as likely to be exercising a month after the baby's born the same as she did before the baby was born. So what is a reasonable time to think about her getting back to her regular exercise pattern? Any
thoughts from the audience or anybody?
I say 6 months.
Oh, we've got a vote for 6 months up here in the front.
Okay.
And I was
going to
say that the type of birth she had, vaginal or C-section.
You looked at
I controlled for it. There was no association. We also looked at I didn't mention all the variables that I looked at. Sometimes it makes it sound like we were data dredging, but we had good reason. No, we're not. You know, how many children did she have? Were there previous children in the household? I mean, all those things we looked at, you know, and they actually weren't related to the level of physical activity, believe it or not. Those variables that I put up were the primary drivers. And, you know, in terms of when should you get back to regular levels of physical activity, so you're saying 6 months, but I would say that you probably want to try to get back as soon as possible. And maybe that's not, you know, 100% of your exercise that you were pre-pregnancy, but, you know, maybe 50%, you know, I don't know. And that's a good question of when, you know, when women should begin. I mean, my feeling is that it should be as soon as possible.
Well, I think it's when should you, but then I think Ken's question is when do you measure it?
Oh, right.
So that we get, you know, kind of get the...
Right, so it's not so skewed from all the other...
Right.
Did you look at breastfeeding?
Yeah, yes. No. Yes. Keep asking and I'll say the same thing. if it was conceivably related to physical activity, you know, we talked to the physical activity group in the department, and they had a lot of good suggestions of other things to look for. And we, of course, were limited by what's in the survey and what's in the birth certificate,
right.
But, you know.
The moderator designed the session for exactly that purposes.
It's a limitation of what you can do with surveillance and administrative data, that there's no way you can ever prove anything.
Absolutely.
But you can generate new hypotheses and new places to look. So, for example, when we looked at, this wasn't Yuri's work, but somebody else's, when we looked at postpartum depression versus antenatal depression, suddenly we find depression during pregnancy is higher than we expected. It means that programs go in different directions. You start talking more to obstetricians, in addition to talking to pediatricians, because the obstetricians are clearly not doing what it looks like the obstetricians are not doing. But you need to go back and
find out.
I mean, when we do something like that, we remember that we're asking 4 months after the baby's born, we're asking a woman, how did you feel during the pregnancy? At the same moment, we're asking, how do you feel now? And there's a lot of recollections that's hard. But if you're doing things contemporaneously and really plan to organize a study, you can learn, you can find out whether this stuff is true or not.
Well, it gives us some direction of the kinds of questions we need to be asking, you know.
And the ways we need to be asking.
Right.
There was something else I wanted to add. There was a poster today. There's actually two posters, but somebody did a poster looking at whether women... So they assessed whether women were given advice by their doctor, specifically about weight loss after pregnancy and about physical activity after the delivery. And they found that whether or not a physician had given them advice about losing weight didn't seem to impact their weight loss, but there might have been timing issues of when they recorded had they lost their weight. I don't remember when that was, but it turns out that if women were given advice about physical activity, they tended to have higher levels of physical activity by their physicians. So one of the things that, you know, at least, you know, our study may point to is that maybe physicians have a role in suggesting that you get back to physical activity as soon as possible. So there are some things that it may lead to, especially, you know, like you said, if you can talk to the obstetricians before and not, you know, put everything on the pediatricians after.
Any other comments or questions from the audience?
Tantra, do you have, Zilla, have plans to do something about screening for depression and pregnancy?
There's one of the groups that I've been working with is the Healthy Baby Learning Collaborative, and there was, and then Los Angeles is divided up into service planning areas, and it was one of the goals that they were going to focus on for the next year in one of the spas was to look at depression during pregnancy and how we can better screen for it and provide support for women, and would just providing, you know, sort of a support group for newly pregnant mothers reduce some of that. So that group is working on it. And
there was a presenter in another session who did an intervention, I believe, in D.C. with African American women, and they were looking at, I guess, multiple factors. Among them was intimate partner violence.
had a lot of different outcomes. I can't remember what it was. But they did, yeah, they were one of the few that actually saw the result carry through to the outcome.
I thought that was really interesting.
And I haven't looked at our depression data enduring to look at, I haven't correlated it to the outcomes yet. That was the other thing I need to do.
In Oregon, when we started to talk with local health departments about increasing screening for depression, quote, for during and after, the answers that we got had to do a lot with, so what are we going to do if we get a positive screening? And it seems like we could overwhelm the system very easily by just doubling the number of referrals.
Right.
And maybe the answer is going to be finding a way to begin the process of raising the referrals and raising the places where people can be referred, because otherwise it's going to be really chaotic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or if, and it's kind of like, you know, not everybody may need cognitive behavioral therapy. Maybe they do need a support group, and so how do you distinguish, you know, those different kind of incremental levels of need and match them up with a kind of an appropriate level of service and support. At least these data indicate, you know, give us a sense that we need to be looking at it in that way, as opposed to somebody that all or nothing.
Any other questions?
Yes. Any other questions or parting comments? I want to give a hand to our presenter. Thank you all for coming on this last session, and we'll see you hopefully at the final closing plenary.
Great, you guys did a great job. It was kind of neat to be able to see how all these service pieces and how all of the work connected. I had hoped it was going to connect, but I wasn't sure when I planned it out. I was like, okay, this should work, but
I
quite know.
I'm
just
surprised
that you're
kind of
on the
it's
not as much productivity.
All right.
Increase.